Welcome to the official podcast of Cryptids, Anomalies, and the Paranormal Society. This is Whispers from the Dark. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Whispers from the Dark. I am your host, Barnaby, and we have a great show today. My guest is an author and a researcher, and we will get to him in just a minute here. Up first, guys, the first season of On the Trail of Undiscovered Beasts, our Paraflix series, is now fully aired. So the whole first season is up on Paraflix. Paraflix is a paranormal streaming platform. The first season of On the Trail of Undiscovered Beasts is all about Bigfoot in Wisconsin, and season two will be coming out later this year. And if you guys want to check that out, you can use promo codes CAPS10 and get 10% off your first 3 months of streaming. Head on over to our store and show your support for all of our merchandise On the Trail of Undiscovered Beasts, Monday Morning Monsters, and this show, Whispers from the Dark. You can get all of our logos and stuff and show your support on anything that you got at wisconsincaps.com. Click on Shop Our Store. And while you're online, make sure you go over to all of our social media platforms. We are on Patreon, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube as Wisconsin Caps and WI Caps on Instagram. And you can find Cryptids, Anomalies, and the Paranormal Society, as well as Whispers from the Dark and Monday Morning Monsters, each have their own pages there. So we have also going to be coming up here this weekend. We are going to be at the Frogman Festival in Mason, Ohio. That's right. This is the inaugural Frogman Festival. And you guys can come check that out later on this later on in March. We will be down in Pickens, South Carolina. And then we will be at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference in May. And back in Rhinelander, Wisconsin for the Hodag Heritage Festival in May. And in June, we head to Canton, Ohio for Monster Fest. That's put on by Small Town Monsters. And then June 9th and 10th, we'll be in Marinette, Menominee, Michigan at the Bigfoot and Paranormal Convention sponsored by Paraflix and the American Ghost Walk Tours. You can get your tickets on our website, wisconsincaps.com, for that. And then we head to MI Paracon. And in September, we're back in South Carolina, and we are back in Wisconsin in September. And we're going to have a lot more events as well coming up, but that's all we're going to be at for now. So, all right, guys, if you're going to check out any of those events, if you missed them, head over to wisconsincaps.com and click on our public events page, and you can see all that and more up-to-date information. All right, guys, our guest this week is an author of two books on Bigfoot, and I would like to bring him on now. Please welcome Levi Makovic. Levi, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Barnaby. Thanks for having me.
Oh, the pleasure is mine, man. Thanks for being on. So you have two books. I got them right here. So this was your first book, A Quest for the Truth, and then your new book is The Sasquatch Paradox. Why don't you tell us a little bit about them and how you got into this?
Well, I've always kind of been into Bigfoot because I heard sightings kind of near where I grew up. But then once I was in college, I just kind of got into the literature. And the more I read into it, the more I just became real interested in the subject. And just kind of went from there. Like, watching all like documentaries and stuff was great when I was growing up. But it just wasn't the same as, like, once you actually, like, read a book and, like, read about the anatomy that exists and, like, footprint casts, like, that just hits you in a different way. And I just got hooked from there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I always like to tell people, like, Bigfooting is like a tree, right? So you have the leaves of the tree are the Finding Bigfoot and the TV shows and all that, that people kind of know a little bit about Bigfoot. You know, the Patterson-Gimlin film is up there and everything, and people just kind of have this rough idea. And then you have the people that dig a little deeper down to the trunk of the tree. And those are the ones that, like, you know, have read the books and have, you know, followed a little bit deeper into these topics and know a little bit more. But there's so much more in the roots of this tree that unless you really delve into the topic that people don't understand about, you know, you'd be surprised how many times at conventions I get asked, you know, there's more than one Bigfoot. Like, I thought there was just one, and it drives me nuts, man.
Or I think what amazes me the most is when people realize like you're serious about the subject, mm-hmm. and they'll come up to you and be like, hey, like, don't tell anybody, but I had this encounter one time, this really weird thing happened to me. And you look and it's like, on like the BFRO website, there's like hardly any reports from these areas. Sometimes there's like none, mm-hmm. but then you'll have like four or five or six people come up to you and they'll tell you these stories, and it's they're like almost embarrassed, like, hey, like don't tell anyone I said this. Like, I'm only telling you because I know you're into this, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you said, that kind of stuff is what lies in the roots of this. And that's where I think whenever I'm doubting the existence of Bigfoot, I look back at that and be like, man, that would be really hard stuff to, like, all that to be fake. Like, it's just the evidence that exists, it is pretty amazing how well it fits together.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. That's a tongue twister. Let's talk a little bit about that. You have these awesome books here. I didn't get a chance to read your first book, but I did get a chance to get through the second one here, the Sasquatch Paradox. And this is out by Hangar One Publishing, Doug Hychek's promotion as well. So that's really cool. He's an awesome guy. I've got to meet him.
Yeah, lucky to meet him. Great dude.
Awesome. Absolutely. So tell us, like, so your book here is, you know, the scientific defiance to the recognition of relic hominoids, sorry. So can you explain that?
Basically, we're taught in schools and, like, we're told by the media that, like, the scientific institutions, this near-perfect institution where you have open-minded scientists who fight really hard to get to the truth and subjects, but in reality, like, it's much different. Because scientists are, in fact, very human, and they are, they're possessed by the same emotional biases that we have that interfere with our ability to see clearly. And because they get kind of, I hate to put it this way, but they get kind of drunk on their own intelligence or on their own intellect. Mm-hmm. So they don't actually, not always, like, this isn't true for all subjects, but it is true for some subjects, including this one, where they don't actually look at it with a critical eye. They just listen to the narrative. They say, oh, the narrative says Bigfoot can't be real, therefore it must not be real, without actually looking into any of the evidence. And they use the narrative as a justification as to why they don't look into the narrative, why they don't look into the subject.
Absolutely. It seems to be like this huge taboo around Bigfoot, and, you know, that this thing is just this mythological creature that supposedly roams the woods like the Easter Bunny or something. And people are so afraid to talk about it in a serious light. You know, we've seen this in the past with, like, the UFO community or the UAPs, that this subject is so taboo that, you know, these things can't be real. But if you look, you know, I'm sure you've watched the news recently and stuff with all of the UFOs that have been shot down and all this, and now people are taking this deeper look into the UFO phenomenon and, you know, the Pentagon reports and all that stuff. Do you think that the same thing kind of needs to happen with Bigfoot?
I don't know, because UFOs, it's just a different field entirely, because there's so many different things that are flying around the skies. Like, we don't have, like, it's not like there's, like, one thing that's a UFO. Mm-hmm. Like, you could see a bird, and if you don't know that it was a bird, like, that counts as a UFO. So, and there are, like, actual government documents that, not necessarily covering up, but have been reported on the UFO subject. I don't think those government documents necessarily exist when it comes to Sasquatch, because like, why would the government care if there's an ape living in the woods? I mean, you'll hear on like military bases where people will report sightings, but those tend to like stop at like one or two steps ahead of them, not all the way up to the top. So if I were to say the what we would need outside of obviously like a body is, I guess we would just need more credible people who stand up and say like, hey, like I saw this. Like if you had somebody who was like a professional athlete who said, yeah, they're real, I saw one, or like some kind of actor or actress, then it would add a little bit of credibility to the field. And honestly, sometimes just bringing attention, like you said, with the UFOs is enough to get the ball rolling in a positive direction.
You know, it's interesting. You touched on a few things there that when you're talking about the UFO topic and stuff, it wasn't, you know, we've been told by these whistleblowers and stuff that when you do the FOIA, the Freedom of Information requests about UFOs, to not refer to them as UFOs, that you should look for other specific keynote words. And I've always wondered, you know, you said that there's no government documents on Bigfoot. Well, what if we're not looking under the right name?
I mean, maybe, but I guess that depends on like what you count as government documents. So if you count like the police as part of the government, then maybe, because I would say like, especially like where I'm from, there's only a town of like 5,000 people and it's pretty decent sized county. So a lot of woods. So there could very well be sightings that the police have documented, but they don't like put out in the public. So, or there's state forest near me in the same way. So, I mean, if you consider that to be part of the government, then yeah, I guess what you're saying could be true about that they exist, or that they exist under just a different name that they use to identify this.
Yeah. You don't know. I mean, for whatever these things are, you know, I cannot personally imagine that with as many documents that have come out, you know, on ESP and telekinesis and remote viewing from the government, that there isn't some file on Bigfoot. Because, you know, whatever this thing is, they've had to have looked into it for as long as this phenomenon has been going on. And for as many people that have, you know, reported these things, it's just a matter of finding what it's classed under to pull that document out. You know, we do have the one document from the government that was the hair samples. I can't remember offhand the guy that...
The FBI, Peter, I think that was Peter Byrne.
Yes, yes. And he submitted the samples for the testing. We do have that document.
Yep.
But, yeah. That's the only government FOIA information that I've seen on the topic. So,
I am personally pessimistic about the government and their ability to keep secrets of like this magnitude. Isn't very. They've done a poor job of it in the past. So that's one of the reasons why I'm not too convinced. But hey, I mean, it most definitely could be true.
Mm-hmm. Well. You know, you never know. But that's barking up a completely different tree, and we've gone down this weird rabbit hole road over here. But let's talk about what we do know. I know your book starts out, and you talk about you know, the evidence, the amount of evidence that we have for these existence of these creatures, and you start out talking about the Patterson-Gimlin film, and. In my personal opinion, I mean, this horse has been beat to death. I mean, if there's people out there that still don't believe that this is a legitimate film, you know, especially after, you know, your book covers it quite in depth, as well as, like you said, John Bendernagel, and of course, Jeff Meldrum's book, Legend Meets Science. If you have any doubt that these things are not a flesh and blood creature existing, or at least Patty, you definitely need to check that out. But can you tell us a little bit briefly just about like some of the evidence and stuff and why you believe that that's to be true?
Well, it's just phenomenal how like when you look at all the little pieces of evidence, they just merge together like so perfectly. Like sightings are the most unreliable form of evidence because humans have really awful memories. Like we have emotions that interfere with our ability to remember. And like, there's a lot of different things that go on. Like if you remembered everything, I think that would just be too much power on some person's brain. Like there's few people have like eidetic memories where they can tell you what happens every single time, every single thing that happened on every single day. And I think that's something that'd be rather like difficult to hold on to, because like if you have something really embarrassing happening to you, you hold on to it for a while, but eventually you remember it. But if you like, if, and this, I know this is a tangent, but like if you remember that forever, it would really eat away at you. So I think that's one of the reasons why we have like bad memories, is so that we can forget stuff that isn't like of the utmost importance. But because of that, we also forget things that are important, or we misremember things. Like I can tell you baseball games I've been to where I can tell you what happened, but I can't tell you like the exact details. And if I would have to swear in court on exact details, and I could very well be wrong on some of those details that I give, not because I'm lying, but just because I misremembered it. So we have to remember that sightings are kind of unreliable, but the important thing to look for sightings is like, what's the overall trend that exists? And because if everybody's reporting the same thing, then it's much less likely to be true that our memories are interfering with everything. I mean, they're sure with the overall story. So sightings have been fairly consistent for like 500 years, like maybe more like 400 years, but they've reported the same things in like the same locations, and like you hear the same things from people all across the globe. And one of the things that always gets me is the fact that there's reports dating back to like 200 years ago of like Sasquatch reportedly whistling, knocking on trees, emitting a bad smell, howling, and one other thing I can't think of. But they did all of this before we knew that the great apes do all of these same things as well. So the fact that these stories precede known great ape behavior is something that is hard to wrap your mind around. Then if you look at how consistent sightings are from like when we, from I don't know, the 1950s when Sasquatch reports really started to explode, to the Patterson-Gimlin film helped really put on the map, till now, like they're pretty much the same. Just they're happening all over. I mean, there's the only difference is like you're getting reports outside of the Pacific Northwest, because before it was mostly like the Pacific Northwest. So it just, to me, just based on the sightings alone and all the small variations that you would expect to see in a population that exists, like the differences in fur color or the differences in behavior, is one of the things that brings me back to like them being real. Because sometimes it's like, come on, they can't possibly exist. But then you run through the evidence and like, okay, but what's the other possibilities then to explain all this evidence? And I mean, I didn't even touch on the Patterson-Gimlin film either. So
like, you totally avoided the question and went down your own road, but that's fine.
Oh, no. I mean, I can get into the Patterson film as well. It's just like the Patterson film like is consistent with everything else as well, because you have the walk shows a compliant gait, which is reported throughout every Sasquatch encounter. There's certain behavior aspects, like when Patty turns herself at her waist instead of at her head, because an ape's skull, the spine attaches higher up on the skull on an ape, like a gorilla, than it does on a human. Humans can freely move their head left and right. Apes can't, because they're more shoulder shrugged. So if they try to turn, their chin hits their shoulder. So what they have to do is they have to open themselves up at their waist and then look. So that's consistent with ape behavior. The very fact that no Hollywood makeup artist made anything anywhere near as similar to this is very compelling, because there are multiple ape suits from that. Well, there's one from that era, which would be 2001 A Space Odyssey. Then there's one 10 years later in 1976's King Kong. And then there's one about 10 years after that, sometime in the late 80s, Rick Baker, who did King Kong, also made Bigfoot and Harry and the Hendersons. So if you look at all those suits and compare them to the Patterson-Gimlin film, they all like show signs of being an ape suit. They all have somewhat decent long hair to cover. The filmmakers do that to cover up any of their mistakes. None of them will turn at the neck like we see with Patty, because they don't want to expose the seam that exists between the headpiece and the chest piece. Their movements are, they're stiff. They're very stiff with the way that they move, because, I mean, they're humans that are wearing a lot of weight and clothing, and not clothing, but in a material that feels uncomfortable. You can see, like, the shape of the head is also inconsistent with what we would need for an ape suit, because humans have this thing, I think it's called the cranial vault, which is basically your forehead. With apes, after their brow ridge, right above their eyebrows, their head tends to shoot back and just form a sagittal crest. So when you're making an ape suit, you kind of exaggerate the features. You make the sagittal crest a lot bigger because it looks like then a normal ape. But it's a lie that Hollywood studios do so that they can hide a person's head in that suit. In the Patterson-Gimlin suit, that doesn't exist. Well, not in the suit. In the Patterson-Gimlin film, that doesn't exist. It's consistent with what we see in apes. And if you put, like, a human skull next to, like, the Patterson-Gimlin head, like, a human's head couldn't fit in that suit, in the quote-unquote suit.
Definitely. Yeah, you make a lot of good points there. And, I mean, the list goes on and on. As I said, you know, with the whole, there's literally a whole book by, you know, I need a drink now. there's literally, you know, the whole book by Jeff Meldrum that goes into every bit of anatomy of the Patterson-Gimlin creature. And, you know, it's beating a dead horse. If you don't believe that that is actually not a person in a costume and a living creature, you need to go check out that book. Or, you know,
Bill Munns. Bill Munns has the best book on it.
Really? I have not read his, though.
When Roger Met Patty, it's the best book.
Okay.
Phenomenal.
Awesome. I'll have to look into that one. Yeah, I don't have a lot of time to actually read, so I have to get audiobooks. And so yours was nice because I got it on the PDF file. I could just have page to text, and I can read it that way.
Oh, sure.
And just listen to it. I work 12-hour days, so I have a lot of time to listen to things. I just don't have time to sit down and read. So
sure.
Anytime I get a book, it's got to be audio. So. But yeah, the other thing you touched on, I want to get into something else here, but you touched on also I can't remember what you call it, but the color variations by region. And I thought that was very interesting. And even the size by region is something that is noted scientifically with other animal species, mm-hmm. and as well with the Bigfoots. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So I live in Wisconsin. And up here, when we deer hunt, you can use deer rifles from like 223, which is kind of small, up to like 300 Win Mags. Down south, when you hunt deer, in like Alabama, you'll use a handgun because they're so small, a deer rifle would just totally destroy the animal. And when you go further north into Canada, you can't use those smaller deer rifles. You have to use something bigger to drop the animals. And that's because animals, the further north they get, grow bigger, and that allows them to become more efficient with the calories that they burn. So they can keep heat in easier because their surface area is smaller compared to their volume, as opposed to when you're a smaller animal. You see this with bears. I mean, think black bear. They're big, but they're not like huge. Grizzly bears are huge, and then you get to polar bears, which are just absolutely enormous. Like, they just get bigger the further north they go. That happens in reports. Like, the ones, like the skunk ape, you hear pretty consistently between 6 and 7 feet there. Here in Wisconsin, like, I've heard between 7 and 9 feet, and then you go up to Canada, like, even Alaska, you hear sometimes, like, 9 up to, like, 12 feet tall. So, it's just, even though, like, people, like we talked about earlier, people see stuff, like they could be inconsistent, they could be wrong with the way that they view this and estimate the size, but we have at least footprints then to verify that this happens, because the footprints themselves get bigger the further north they go. And if to think of how that would happen by chance, Imagine if, like, you just mark off on North America, like, 10 different slots that are horizontal. So it's like the further north you get into new slots. And each slot, everybody's rolling a dice from, like, 1 to 10. And, like, somehow everybody averages out to where it gets bigger the further north you get. Is, I know that may sound a little weird, but, like, if you think about that, that's exactly what it's kind of like with the footprints that are happening. Like, they're getting bigger the further north, but how can people know what size to make them if they're faking them, unless you have like an absolutely enormous team that's faking them and putting footprints out into the woods, which once again, that doesn't make much sense at all. And with bear, like you see some places black bears are black, other places black bears are actually like, people confuse them for grizzly bears. They look just like grizzly bears. They've got different colors. Grizzly bears, some of them are dark brown, some of them are light brown, some of them are in between. So, like, it's just natural that animals have a variation in that their color, and, like, these variations point to them being the living population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we've said, you know, like, you're talking about, like, getting bigger and stuff. I've heard a lot of more reports out of, like, Oklahoma and Texas of the really big ones. And I know of 24-inch footprints down in Kentucky and Tennessee. So that's, I mean, those are big creatures down there as well. So you do have some, at least in the southern states here, that are these ginormous creatures. So
yeah, and you'd expect, like, with populations for there to be some kind of variance. Mm-hmm. Like, with sometimes you get, like, deer that are, like, 230 inches on their racks here, like that's way bigger than what the average is. But I mean, they still get shot every once in a while. There's one shot by me last year, I think, and it was like a state record bow buck. So it's most bow bucks you see are like 120 to 150 inches, but this one was like over 100 inches more than average. So sometimes you just get those freaks of nature that are absolutely enormous compared to everyone else.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about size variations and stuff as well. You know, one of the major arguments that I always get for these things is that there's not enough food for these things to exist, that something of that size could not survive on the food population that we have. And that always bothers me, because you look at things like, you know, moose, or as you said, like polar bears. I mean, these creatures, you know, can be even bigger than a Sasquatch, and those things are out there, and we know that they exist. Look at an elephant. You know, the amount of calories and the diet that they have to consume on a daily basis to survive, and they're still out there. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, like why do people think that these things couldn't exist because of their diet?
Well, I think people have that narrative in their mind that they can't exist, so they just look for a justification for that narrative. Oh, well, because of the food, but they don't actually think about that. Because if you look, like you said, moose are enormous, and yet somehow they find enough calories to survive. And the hard thing about that is that they're a herbivore, so they don't even touch meat. So if you have an animal that can grow big but can survive both on meat and on vegetables or like plants, like you widen your food source like that much more. And why can't they exist based on that? Because we have grizzly bears that grow up to like 1,200, 1,400 pounds in North America. So is it really that unreasonable? There are hundreds of thousands of black bears in the woods. Like, is it that unreasonable if we can sustain populations of that size that we couldn't add some population of something similar size as well?
Oh, definitely. You know, everything has to have its own like ecological niche, you know, and you know, Meldrum has a whole talk about how these things survive anywhere that bears survive. And you have these very similar diets of these omnivores where they eat plants or they eat the meats. And if these things can survive anywhere a bear can, they can also alternate what they're eating to fit into that niche, you know, between plants or fish or berries or, you know, deer as things go. I've heard one theory that throughout the summer when berries and food and that are plentiful, that's what they consume. And during the winter months is when they focus more on the hunting of deer or elk or other like meat sources. Have you heard any of that?
Well, I mean, it only makes sense because deer survive on when the crops start to come up. They start eating corn and soybeans during the fall, but they don't do that during the spring. They have to find other resources. And like we know, bears do that very thing. Well, bears, I mean, they're sleeping during the winter, but they alternate their diet throughout the year. So it's not that big of a stretch of the imagination to think that another animal that's in a similar ecological role would act in that same way. And if you think about the way that what we did in North America, humans, I should say, Europeans specifically, once we spread across North America, one of the first things we did was we wiped out the grizzly bear. We wiped out Sasquatch's biggest competition. So it's not like our spreading hurt them. It would have helped them. Yeah. California has a grizzly bear in its state flag. There's no grizzly bears in California because they killed way too many people. So they nerfed them. They killed them all. And if you think 50% of the sightings occur at night, most human activities during the day. So points of the Sasquatch likely being a nocturnal animal. And if it's a nocturnal animal, it probably didn't come that way overnight. It's been that way for a long time. So the grizzly bears active during the day, same time humans are active, kills humans. Humans then kill the grizzly bears. Well, Sasquatch is active at night anyway, so it's not going to be affected by any of this at all. Although there definitely are sightings during the day. It just means when they're most active, it's probably at night. So we killed off the biggest competition, which would have left resources and just food, not just food, but like territory as well for the animals to go into that maybe they couldn't have gone to before. And we also clear-cutted a lot of the trees and the forests that existed. So that would have congregated a lot of the deer, a lot of like the herd species into the smaller area of forest. So like we would have helped anything out like this that exists.
Absolutely. Very cool, man. Awesome. Good stuff. And that's what we were talking about as far as, you know, like the roots of this. You know, people like all these topics that we've been covering are, you know, these typical arguments that people have as to why these things can't exist. But the average person out there that sees, you know, even down to the trunk of this tree hasn't delved down into the roots to see how these animals are existing or potentially existing to understand how they fit into the natural order of what's out there. So,
well, if we, all these things that are saying, like, they all fit together really well. But what's unique about like the Sasquatch phenomena is like there's not like one piece of evidence that's so amazing that it's going to convince everybody. But at the same time, it's a bunch of small pieces of evidence that when taken together points to the conclusion that Sasquatch is real. But if you were to take out some of this stuff, let's say all the footprints are fake, well, there's still a lot of stuff you have to answer for with like sightings, the audio, the video. Let's say all the video is fake. Well, then the footprints point to something weird happening. So does like the Native American story. So like if you eliminate one or two of the pieces of the puzzle, we still have a pretty clear picture that exists, which is kind of different than a lot of other areas. Like a lot of areas, like you eliminate a couple of the main pieces of evidence, like you're left with nothing. But here you're left with actually quite a bit still.
Absolutely. So I had said that in your book, you were talking about, you know, the Patterson-Gimlin footage and why that it was, you know, legitimate and not a man in a suit. And I said that was a beaten horse. Everybody's talked about that. But in your book, you also talk about a series of two photographs from down in Florida, the Mayaca ape photos. And I got them up here. I wanted to show them and have you kind of talk a little bit about them, because these are a piece of evidence that I've seen and heard about and stuff, but not many people actually have talked about on shows or even in their books that I've read. So if we can kind of talk a little bit about that, that'd be cool.
The Myakka ape photos, the story behind them is that some woman back in the early 2000s said that something was stealing apples off of her porch. So one day she had her camera ready and she heard this thing on her porch. Or maybe it was like apples on like the tree nearby, and she heard it, so she ran out and she took two photos of this thing. So this is the first photo, and then this is the second photo. So these are the two photos that she took of the thing. And she wrote an anonymous letter to the local police, attached the photos, and said, "Hey, like my grandchildren play around here. This looks like an orangutan. Is somebody missing an orangutan?" And at first glance, like this does look exactly like an orangutan, like the color, like the face. But when you look at the photo a little bit longer, like you realize like that's probably not the case, because first off, those plants that are in front of me, I forgot what they're called, but at this state they're about 4 or 5 feet tall. So in this first photo with the creature like leaning over, that would be like the tallest orangutan that exists in the world right there. And this is in the state of Florida. Orangutans are not native to the state of Florida. No, they do live in the tropical region and like I forgot the Sumatra and Indonesia.
Borneo.
Yeah, Borneo. Thank you, Borneo. So they live in those tropical regions, so I'm sure it's somewhat similar to Florida, but to suggest that an animal of this size could live in Florida doesn't make much sense, because it's, let's say it's an escaped zoo animal. It'd have to be one of two things, an escaped zoo animal or an escaped slash released pet that somebody had. But in both those situations, the orangutan would be used to surviving off of humans. It would be used to humans providing it for food. So you would expect there to be a lot more sightings of this specific individual in this area. That's not really the case. This is the only real sighting of this particular thing, unless there's a bunch of them that are hidden that we don't know of, but as we know, there aren't really any other sightings. So if this is an escaped orangutan, it would have to survive on its own after having been fed and by humans for all of its life. And then to expect that it would reach a size that's greater than orangutans that exist in natural habitats is really unusual, because orangutans grow to about 4 or 5 feet high. Like, that's about it. But you can see in that second photo, the figure is standing real tall. Like, it's noticeably taller from the first, and it's got a little bit of hunch in its back, so it can still stand even taller. The woman estimated the figure to be about 6.5 to 7 feet tall. And I don't know if that's as standing now or overall, but that's significantly taller than the tallest orangutan. And if you look at like weight-wise, I think like the most obese orangutans, like the ones that are like morbidly obese, grow up to like 350 or 400 pounds. But that's like not normal for ones living in the wild. I think they're closer to 250 pounds, maybe 300 pounds. But this thing that's standing there is like absolutely enormous. I don't think I'm overestimating when I say it could be 500 or 600 pounds. Like, and that's a pretty conservative estimate based on how just massive this animal is. So you're talking about an animal that's taller and much bigger than any known orangutan that we know of, like in a non-native habitat. It just kind of defies common sense.
One of the things that I'm noticing here, like I've done a lot of like zoology. I've gone to a lot of zoos and stuff, you know, and researched these creatures and that. This thing is definitely the wrong color for an orangutan. You know, I've seen a lot of orangutans. There's different subspecies of orangutans as well, and this thing is very dark, even for being at night in the pictures and stuff, obviously. But it's a very dark, and even you can see here, I can point to this coloration here under what would be like the chin area and stuff. This is like grays, and you would only see like a gray coloration more in like the the blacker fur and stuff, not the reddish as that. So yeah, it does have orangutan features in that, but I can't see this thing being an orangutan.
And as you can see in the second photo, like a figure opens up its mouth, mm-hmm. which looks like to be in a realistic reaction from an animal. Because if you're taking flash photography out in the middle of the woods at night, you take a picture of something, yeah, you start out the first time, and the second time, it's going to react. And how it's reacting is it's telling the woman, like, back off. It's showing its teeth because it's letting them know, like, I mean business. So it that does add credibility to the thing being at least a living animal. I've heard some people say it's a cutout, or some people say it's, like, a doctored thing, but I'm not too convinced by that argument, but mm-hmm. who knows?
Well, it does move in the picture. If you take a look at this fern right here, or whatever this thing is, you can see this in both the pictures. I'll go back to the other one, and that would be this one. You can tell that this thing is stood up. If it was a cutout, it wouldn't be able to move like that, obviously. So whatever this thing is, it's there. But you're looking down here, you can see that this looks like it'd be like the foot way down here in the bottom here. And just looking at the size of this creature, whatever it is, it's big. I mean, you said it was, you know, these things are supposed to be about 4 feet tall, but I mean, 4 feet is the hip of this thing, I would say, you know, and you got the arm draping down here. And this one, you can kind of see even the mouth is a little bit open. One thing I noticed, though, about this is these pictures appear to have, like, canine teeth. And that's something that you don't have reported a lot in Bigfoot encounters. They're all supposed to be more the square molar types. Have you heard about that or given any thought to that of this one?
No, not too much, because I would say that the most likely explanation is that, because, I mean, let's say you compare this to the Patterson-Gimlin film, or even better, compare this to the figure in the Stacy Brown film. Okay. These are two completely different figures. Like, mm-hmm. they don't look alike at all. So is it possible that you have two species that are closely related but aren't the exact same species living in the same spot, and that's why you have different variations? That, I mean, that could be a possibility, but I don't know enough about, like, teeth or, like, dental anatomy to make any, like, conclusions on this.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I just noticed on this one, it looks very, very much like this
would be
like...
There's definitely a point. Yeah, there's a point.
Canine tooth there, yeah. But, and it doesn't look like all the other, the foliage and stuff is running opposite to that. So, now, have you heard anything about this actually being a video?
No, because the woman said she had a flash photography camera.
Okay.
So she just took two different pictures.
Okay. Yeah, I had heard that it was videos, and then I had heard that there might have been actually a video that these were screenshotted off of. So I wasn't sure if you had heard that story, but
I mean I could be wrong. I've never heard that story, but it definitely could be the case.
Yeah. I don't know. And the other thing I was interested in is I cannot find a, like, you see the first photo in the series here is long, right? So it's what do we call it? Hot dog shape. Yeah. The photo runs diagonal here. And this one is upright. And I cannot find a photo of this that runs the other way.
I think it's just because somebody cropped it. Maybe when Lauren, I think it's Lauren Coleman's the one who got access to the photos, and he's the one. Like, these are from him, so I don't know if he did that or if that was done while he grabbed it, so.
I don't know. Yeah, I was shopping around online last night for looking for these, and I could not find any full photo of this one. So I know one of these was from Lauren Coleman. So, yeah, you're right about that. And the other one, I can't remember who was the other guy that was looking at them, but wrote a whole thing about it as well. But they're definitely interesting. I mean, whatever that thing is, it's too blurry to kind of see, you know, like you said, with like a costume or something like that. But it's definitely interesting.
Well, it's definitely an early 2000s picture too.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's a film photograph, we'll say.
Yeah. So, like, yeah. I remember those as a kid, like taking pictures, and like you thought it looked so good now, but now you have like phones and like ultra HD cameras that make pictures like this look archaic.
You go back and watch a lot of the old movies and stuff like that, you know, I don't know, like a lot of the 80s films and stuff that you thought were so good, and now you watch them back and they're just so grainy and I don't know, just the comparison of the quality and stuff from then and today. But you know, the old footage and stuff like that with the film is actually better than the digital, because film you can go in and get a much more deeper zoom into a lot of those footage, you know, obviously like even the Patterson-Gimlin film, the reels of footage from that, you can enhance a lot more than you can with digital, because digital records at a certain pixel ratio, whereas the film footage is actually a printed copy of what it saw and imprinted on that negative. So it can be enhanced a lot more than your digital stuff can these days. So,
well, to run with that, one of the complaints against the Patterson-Gimlin film is that it's grainy. But there's two problems with that, and that's one is that most people who view the Patterson-Gimlin film are looking at a zoomed-in video. They aren't looking at the actual one. It's zoomed in. So when you zoom in, you're going to lose some quality. It's not going to look as good as when you view it from back. And second is that it's not the original copy. Most people view like a second or third generation copy. And so they would copy their film, and when artifacts get added and blurriness gets added. So the original is not that blurry. It just looks that way because of the generation that you're viewing. I mean, I think it's Isaac Tien is working on an Ultra HD or a 4K restoration of the Patterson-Gimlin film. And like, it looks beautiful and like what parts you can see. So,
That's definitely a good point as well. You know, like we were talking about with the roots and stuff, people just, you know, well, this is a really crappy picture. Yeah, it is. You do have a very crappy picture of it, but maybe if you went and looked for a better copy of that, one of the original footage or a, you know, I mean, there's so many things, you know, even like the Mayaka Ape stuff that I just showed you, there's some really crappy versions of that out there as well, you know, and it's all which version of it that you see. That, you know, people can say, well, that's a person in a costume. Well, sure, if you look at the version you have, it does look like that. But here, look at this better version, you know, and you can see a lot more definition on that. I know I had Michael. I can never remember people's names when I need them. He just wrote the book on his father's evidence. Just came out by Doug Hychek as well. Oh. Michael Friedman. I just had him on the show. And his footage, his dad's footage, that you can look at two different versions of that, and you can see a lot more detail as he's talking about in the book. You can pull up their footage that they got a better enhanced, and you can see like the Sasquatch leans down and picks up an infant in the video. And you don't see that at all in the footage that you can find, you know, every day
on YouTube. Yeah, that one on YouTube, it doesn't look anything special. I've had friends who've told me it's a great video. It's like, I don't see anything, but that's a good point. Like, if I'm watching the wrong version, then I'm not going to see anything.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Well, so I wanted to give you the opportunity again. We talked about you have two books out. You have the Quest for the Truth. That was your first book. And then your new one, The Sasquatch Paradox. Where can people find that and get copies of those?
So for the Sasquatch, the only one that's available right now is The Sasquatch Paradox, because it's basically just like a clean version of the original one. So this is the one that people should buy. Hangar One Publishing is where you can find it. I don't buy anything from Amazon. I only buy, especially like books, I only buy it from like the publisher or like used places, because I want to support the authors. So that's why I would ask you to go Hangar One Publishing. I mean, you can find it on Amazon if you want to purchase. I'm not going to tell you not to buy it, but Hangar One Publishing is Doug's publishing company, Doug Hijacks, and he's got a lot of other good books on there as well. So,
yep. Friedman's book is on there and a ton of other ones as well. He's got a lot of stuff. Very cool. And if people want to get a hold of you or contact you, I know you do research in Wisconsin as well here, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Well, I mean, I'm going to law school this fall, so I'm kind of like tapering off my research. I haven't been like as active as I have been in years past, but I'm not really active on anything like social media or anything. So, I mean, just contact Emily from the fourth floor. She'll send you my way if you want to get a hold of me, because that's where I've been on the most podcasts, and Emily's much more responsive on that stuff than I am.
That's how I got a hold of you. So
Yep.
Emily's great. I had her on my other show as well, and she's an amazing researcher and a wealth of knowledge in the forest floor. If anybody's interested in checking that out, so definitely. Actually, her episode hasn't come out. It airs in March, so I guess you can't check out that episode with her. But
Oh,
it will be out. It will be out in March.
shortly.
I'm going to be down in South Carolina, as I said at the beginning of the show there. And I'll be traveling home from South Carolina on Monday. So her episode actually airs recorded on the Monday that I'm coming back from South Carolina. So
Oh,
it's
cool.
at the end of March her episode airs. So Emily will be
Will
on it.
hers come out before this one?
This one will be out prior to
Oh,
that
okay. That's funny. That's funny.
one. That's definitely interesting. So she does talk about you in the episode and gives you a lot of credit and talks about your book, because we were talking on the episode, or we will be, like, I gotta do this whole time phenomenon weird thing going on here. We will be talking about the sciences, like, just neglect to touch this topic, and she brings up your book and talks a little bit about you. So that's how I got on to find out more about you, as I reached out to her about that. So
Sure. So
yeah. But yeah, very cool, man.
it's a small community. Like, you can get to know people very quickly.
Yeah, it's amazing how many people are connected that you don't know. You know, like actually, I'll have to tell you this off air, but I have a story to tell you off air. I have a question for you. But yeah, so I guess that kind of wraps it up. So everyone should go out and check out your book, The Sasquatch Paradox, and you can get that from Hangar One Publishing. And it's a very, very well-written book, very good. A lot of very thought-out arguments as to explaining, you know, why these things are legitimate and why you should, you know, take a closer look at it, and encouraging people to go do that. So awesome, man. Well, I appreciate your time. I'm going to wrap this up, and if you can hang around after the show, I will tell you my little story here.
Sounds good.
All right, guys. Thanks for watching this week's episode of Whispers from the Dark. We'll be back next week with more. So until next time, we'll see you out there. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Whispers from the Dark. To find out more about cryptids, anomalies, and the Paranormal Society, visit us at our website at wisconsincaps.com. That's Wisconsin, CAPS.com. There you can find links to all of our social media: Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and our Patreon. You will see links to our online store as well, where you can get t-shirts, DVDs, and more. If you click on the public events page, you can find out where you can meet us in person and all the public events we have coming up. If you enjoy our podcast or our YouTube shows, please consider becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/WisconsinCaps. There you can find behind-the-scenes pictures and videos from all of our media, as well as bonus footage and evidence that we have collected. If you have encountered something you can't explain, we want to hear from you. Visit our website and click on Submit a Report on our main screen. You can choose to leave your contact information or simply remain anonymous. You can also reach us via email at wisconsincaps@gmail.com. If you would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us on our Whispers from the Dark podcast page on Facebook, or send us an email at wisconsincaps.com. Remember to like, share, and subscribe wherever you listen or watch or find us.